Dennis, this first question will be for you. How was the war party formed, and who led the campaign against the Midianites?
Well, thousands of reaches of 12 tribes were kind of drafted into this war party. Of course, the Midianites, I guess, probably Moses descended from Abraham and Keturah. I guess Moses and his father-in-law were Moses' wife and his father-in-law were Midianites. But anyway, the second part of Phinehas, Eleazar's son, had a holy ark and a signal trumpet against it. What I could read, I think he went to his father, Eleazar, because possibly Eleazar's advanced age. And Joshua is thought by all that I read to be the general of the campaign.
Yeah, very good. Who wants to add to that? I don't have a map for you, but Midian, as far as I could tell, lived to the east of Moab, on the east side of the Dead Sea. You can imagine Israel, and some of this territory, at least, was what was allotted to Reuben later on, when the children of Israel entered into Canaan. Who wants to add to that? Lauren?
As for who led, I just lost my page. Joshua 23:9 says it was the Lord who led this campaign. So
yes,
there were several men involved, but it was the Lord who ultimately led the campaign. And Dennis talked a little bit about Phinehas. It's kind of interesting that he was the one when this event they're taking vengeance for happened that was very zealous during that. Mm. And so now he is the spiritual leader of this campaign. And then there is some debate. Kaufman pointed out that it may not have been a literal thousand. There was the word could have been for division, so there could have been more than 12,000 men in this fighting force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to go off of the idea of Eleazar specifically, the high priest, of course, couldn't have gone into battle for a couple reasons, but most obvious of coming into contact with blood, dead bodies, any sort of defilement. And so it made sense for Eleazar, but as you said, I didn't make that connection. That's very interesting, that if anyone had a vested interest in revenge against Midian, it would have been Eleazar. And Deuteronomy 20, verse 2, tells us that the priest was accompanying the army. That was a common occurrence. And this was presumably to stir up the people, to act as a sort of religious counselor, guidance for the people as well. Who wants to add to that? Lance? Yeah.
Some of these raise more questions than it did answers, but one thing I thought was interesting was the holy instruments, mm-hmm. Which there was a little bit on this that I read through the commentaries, but I don't think that was referring to the ark, because that was historically brought out later. The ark, the Urim, and the Thummim were carried out later in Israel's history. They seem to think it has to do, refers to trumpets. I know we've talked about trumpets before. If anybody has any more on that, I'd be interested to hear it. That was just one point I had. And another thing was in verse 1, the phrase, "Afterward you shall be gathered to your people." I thought that was interesting simply because in Genesis 25:8, it says, "Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people." And then the second one, Genesis 49:33, when Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Both of those seem to me to be talking about death and dying. But as we know, Moses didn't die among anybody else. Nobody knows where he was buried. So, you know, in the first verse where it says that, I just thought it was interesting how the same phrase, you know, was used in English translation.
That is, yeah. I've always taken it to be just sort of a general phrase for dying, but you're right, and Moses wasn't gathered to his people in the same way, yeah.
Well, I did read here that I think this was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Mm. This is what they had to say. I don't know if it's right or not, but basically it's kind of like God is not the God of the dead. He's the God of the living, whether they're alive or dead to men. And, you know, him going into Israel and things like that, kind of like being before those people after mm-hmm. cleansing and stuff, is kind of like a lot. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, certainly Moses lived on among the people. It's interesting, too, to think on that. You know, God says, take vengeance on the Midianites, and then afterward you be gathered to your people. There's not any indication that Moses dragged his feet on that. He delayed it, you know. Certainly that would be human nature. I'm going to do something and then I'll die. Maybe I'll delay doing it. But it seemed like Moses carried this out in a pretty timely manner. Although some do speculate that, you know, a few chapters back, I think it was 25, it had been told God had judged Midian and said, you know, that there will be retribution, but it wasn't carried out until now. And so there is some debate about, you know, whether that was on purpose or postponed for whatever reason. We don't really know. But it seems that Moses was acting completely in accordance with his instruction from God. Who else? To go off the holy instruments a little bit, I'm not going to get too far into this, but yeah, I actually read both sides, and there's some good arguments for both sides. The alarm trumpets that Dennis mentioned, that seems to be the most common consensus, and the idea being that the word, let's see, in verse 6, with the holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hand, that article and could also be rendered even, and so specifying what these holy instruments are. But on the flip side, let's see, it is a plural word that's used for these holy instruments. So it couldn't be the ark, since that would have been singular. And since Phinehas was not high priest, it couldn't have been the Urim or the Thummim. But at the same time, let's see, I think it was the pulpit commentary mentioned that the word for instruments is usually rendered as vessels, as it is in Numbers 3, verse 31. So usually that word is rendered holy vessels, which would lend credence to the ark. And the ark did precede Israel on occasion. Numbers 10:33, as you mentioned later, it did precede Israel into battle. Numbers 14:44 seems to indicate that maybe it had in the past. Again, it's all speculation, but I think the trumpets makes the most sense. But they're compelling arguments both ways. It's interesting to argue about. Who else? Let's see, a couple more of my scattered observations. A vengeance for the Lord, I thought was interesting. This is specified in verse 2, I'm not sure the verse, but the phrase vengeance of the Lord is used specifically. In other words, not vengeance for Israel, not vengeance just for the people that die. This is supposed to be a holy cause, not a personal cause. It's specified as such. Anyone else? All right. Question two then. Lance, this one will be for you. What was the outcome of the battle against Midian?
Well, Midian suffered a great loss. They slew all the males, and this was in accordance with the divine orders. We can see another example of this in Deuteronomy 20, verse 13. Also among the slain were the kings of Midian. Joshua 13, verse 21. Even all the cities of the plain and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses struck with the chiefs of Midian, Evi, Rechem, and Zer, and Hur, and Reba, and the princes of Sihon, who lived in the land. They also slew Balaam with the sword. Numbers 24, we see Balaam set out for his home in Mesopotamia, but apparently got sidetracked and remained among the Midianites. Balaam got his just reward for his deeds and for putting a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, Revelation 2, verse 14. And the children of Israel took all the women of Midian as captives and their little ones, and took the spoil of their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods.
Yeah. Very good. One thing I've neglected to mention for the first question, it is interesting, in chapter 25, Moab and Midian are complicit in that, but Midian is the people that are punished here. And it's sort of interesting to wonder. We address that a little bit in chapter 25, why that is. But Midian basically weaponized sin against Israel, and that's why they're facing this retribution. And for whatever reason, Moab's retribution was delayed. Let's see. Okay. Maybe a couple more things. You alluded to Balaam, and it's kind of interesting to wonder. We address this as well in chapter 24, I believe, why Balaam ends up in Midian. There are lots of wild speculations as to why and how, but ultimately Balaam got what he deserved. He got the judgment that was in keeping for someone in his position who resisted the word of God and ultimately was complicit in helping to undermine God's people. Balaam got what was coming to him. Bart?
Yeah, a couple observations. Zer, listed in verse 8, may have been the father of Cosby, the princess that Phinehas killed along with Zimri. That's interesting. It's also fascinating that, and you sort of alluded to this, but Eleazar, or Phinehas rather, was the one who was so zealous back in chapter 25. And yet here we have a situation where they bring back captives. And it seems that, as you pointed out, Phinehas' zeal was tempered by, you know, his human feelings, as he perhaps was uncertain about exactly the right course to pursue. And so they took the women captive. As, you know, in Deuteronomy, it talks about that when you go to battle in this conquest of the Promised Land, that all adults are to die when they go to battle. And so whether or not that is something that had been covered by Moses prior to this event, or maybe it was something that Moses covered after this event and specifies, interesting to speculate, but as far as I know, you know, we can't really ascertain at this point.
Yeah, the reaction seems to be tempered as well. This isn't a Saul bringing back captives and spoils reaction. So, again, make of that what you will. One really interesting point that I wanted to stress on this, I didn't find it in a lot of commentaries, but I think it's really important to understanding this. And I don't want to spoil the rest of the chapter, but Israel is able to completely wipe out Midian with no casualties. And militarily, that's a difficult, if not impossible, thing to do. And so there are a lot of speculations as to why that might be. But I think the most realistic is that this was a partial judgment on certain tribes, groups within Midian that had occupied, or that were occupying parts of Canaan, which would later be given to Reuben. And I think that, again, for at least two reasons, this would explain the ease of the victory of the people if they were fighting an entire race. Certainly you'd think it would be a closer battle. Midian was a nomadic people, so there was that advantage. Israel was a little bit hardened by now after marching for 40 years. But still, you would think Midian would have put up more resistance. And ultimately, Midian doesn't disappear after this chapter. If we stopped at the end of chapter 31, and as it's written, we would think that Midian's been completely wiped out. But that's not the case. In fact, within about 200 years, by Judges 6, Midian is oppressing Israel. They're more powerful than Israel. So some Midianites managed to survive for whatever reason. Maybe they fled. Maybe they were away. Maybe there were different groups. We don't know. But Midian as a whole does survive. And so perhaps that's part of the reason why this victory is so easy for Israel. Ultimately, God controlled it. Certainly, God could have made a victory as hard or as easy as he wanted to. But in this case, it seems that Israel had a particularly easy time routing the men of Midian. Anyone else? Okay. Question three, then. Grant, this one will be for you. Why was Moses angry with the officers of the army?
It seems fairly clear from verse 15. It says, "Have you kept the women alive?" So this could be a great surprise that actually let this part of the population survive. And then in verse 16, they say exactly why they're upset about this. It says, "Because the children of Israel to transgress against the Lord." We see that they're acting in this rebellion, or the transgression of Peor, that they were the reason, mainly to blame for that that incident, and they were to be killed because of it. And then, of course, in verse 17, it says, "Here's what you're supposed to do now that you know what you've done wrong. Here's why, and then kill all the male children and all the women who have known a man." So it was a very harsh judgment, as you mentioned at the outset, against this entire group of people. As they're trying to be lenient, see that the exact judgment they're supposed to deal with is supposed to be a very harsh, severe judgment. And that's why we were upset. That's back in Joshua, and then we see in the future, in Joshua 6, when they go to attack Jericho, that when they don't do the exact same thing they're supposed to do, that they again are cursed because of what they do.
Very good. Sort of unique as well in this case, because typically Israel would have had the most quarrels with the men of a group of people. But in this case, if anyone within Midian was guilty, was deserving of judgment, that would have been the women who were complicit in seducing Israel. So this is a sort of a unique case in that sense. Who else? Bart?
Yeah, when we studied this, we talked about how just a little bit later, at the city of Jericho is Rahab, mm-hmm. who is spared. She was a harlot, but she recognized the power of God and desired to be a follower of God, so she was spared. And so it seems that none of these women were in that situation. I just wanted to speak to your introductory comments, and this is a difficult, obviously, passage, but we talk about it, and the thing I struggle the most with is not that these people were killed, but they were killed through God's agents, the Israelites, right? God has the right to, obviously, he creates us, and he has the right to take, and he does. We all die, we're all going to die if the Lord doesn't come back before. And so everyone dies, and men, women, and children, it's 100% death rate. And, it hasn't been that long ago that this nation, was involved. We bombed Dresden in Germany during World War II, and 100,000 people died in that bombing. There are other events that you could easily think of where large numbers of people died. And so the difficulty with this for me is that you have individuals carrying this out, and obviously it was very difficult for them to do. But I think perhaps they also had support from the war, so they didn't develop mental illness or any of those things associated with it. So it was something that God supported them in, and they were doing what was just and right. God certainly had the right to do this. If these women were allowed to assimilate into the nation of Israel, and there's a large number of them, there were 32,000 young women that had no men, as we read. So there was a large group of people, a large confederacy, as you mentioned. And so this would have affected Israel had these women been allowed to assimilate into the nation. So while it is difficult to our modern sensibilities, certainly God has the right to take anyone's life at any moment, as he does, as we die. And this is it's a matter of religious purification. It's a matter of keeping the nation of Israel safe and away from corruption so that the Messiah eventually can come through. And I certainly think we know God is perfectly just. We know God is righteous in every way beyond our understanding. And so it's certainly not up to us to question what happened. I totally understand. I think if you're not affected by this chapter, then, you're not human. But if you consider the flood, the flood destroyed the ancient world, men, women, and children. If you consider Sodom and Gomorrah, men, women, and children. If you consider Job's life, his family died except for his wife. And so there are many other instances in the scripture where God has the absolute right, the absolute authority to take life as he deems it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as you mentioned, it's just difficult with our modern lens. It's very in vogue now to look back and judge history through our modern ethics. And again, it's a completely different world. And as you mentioned, ultimately, God is in control. The righteous judge will do right. Who else? Lance?
I just had a couple of verses I wanted to read real quick. And Deuteronomy 20 and 21, it has like laws concerning war and things like that. Mm-hmm. Specifically in chapter 21, starting in verse 10, when you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them unto your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her, and will take her for your wife. And you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go into her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. And it goes on from there. But I just think it's interesting how God does have a plan for everything. And maybe that's why they were surprised whenever, they brought everybody back pretty much. So I don't know. I don't know what their rules of engagement were before that, or their speech, or, what their instructions were. But maybe that's why they were surprised, because they probably should know that beforehand. So anyway.
See, one other small observation. Moses meets them outside the camp, which is interesting. I think it was Jameson Fawcett and Brown gave three potential reasons for this. The first being to show respect, to meet these soldiers coming back who won this great victory, meet them on the way back, to take interest in what happened. Ultimately, Moses and his party would have been interested to know how the battle went. And it kept them from defiling the camp. That might be the most straightforward explanation. These men who had been touching dead bodies, probably still bloodied. Certainly them coming back into the camp would have defiled their families, their tents, the articles they touched. And so this made sense for a lot of reasons to meet them outside the camp. Just another detail that we can lose our reading through this chapter. Anyone else? All right, Lauren, you get question number four. Then why was it necessary that some of the plunder and soldiers be purified?
Well, to your this previous point, in Numbers 19:16, it says, whoever in an open field touches one who is slain by a sword or who has died or a bone of a man or a grave shall be unclean 7 days. So this definitely applied to what these men were going through here. Slain by the sword means killed in battle, so they would be clean and unclean for 7 days. So they had to undergo the purification process detailed in Numbers 19 using the ashes of the red heifer. As for the plunder, I couldn't find any specific rules about the metals and so forth, but there were kind of a precedent to purify objects, you know, based on vessels that were used in sin offerings, things that were touched by unclean animals, and lepers. You can see this in Leviticus 6:28, Leviticus 11:33, and 15:12.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, it seems like there are two classes of materials in verse 20. Talk about the purifying, which presumably was done according to chapter 19, but it seems like in 21 to 24, this is a new thing that Eleazar is giving. As you mentioned, there doesn't seem to be any explicit instruction for how to purify metals, spoils. And again, this is Israel's first real proactive conquest. And so at least one commentator pointed out that this is, it seems, the first instance of the high priest telling people what the law as delivered to Moses meant or was, and then applying it to a special circumstance. And we don't know. Maybe Eleazar had discussed this with Moses before. Maybe it was revealed. Well, it would have been given to him one way or another. But it seems, at least from how it's given in verses 21 to 24, that this is given of his own authority. This is Eleazar giving, based on what he has received from God, ordinances to the people as to how to purify these metals. And that's interesting for a couple reasons, but the most obvious being that we're shifting now away from the era of Moses for the children of Israel. And so it's going to be more and more incumbent upon the priesthood to take over the role that Moses sort of filled, in a sense, of the spiritual leader of the people. And so Eleazar, it seems at least in this section, is beginning to step into that role a little bit. Bart?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm sure you read this. Some of the commentators take the point that this entire chapter is typical of Christianity and of those who will be saved through gospel warfare. And that's based on Revelation 14, where there are 12,000 taken from each tribe. So not a total of 12,000, but 12,000 from each tribe. It's also interesting, by the way, that the number of people that died in the plague in chapter 25 at Baal Peor that the Midianites caused was 24,000, which is another you know, multiple of 12,000. So you, and then in the book of Revelation, you have 144, 12 times 12,000. And these were not defiled. They are virgins. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They're redeemed among men, their first fruits, in their mouth no deceit. So a type, perhaps, of the regeneration that would occur at Mount Zion and be found in the church. And then this idea of purifying with fire or with water, obviously those are types of how we're purified. Peter uses the precious gold idea quite a bit in his first epistle, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things such as silver and gold. Back in a few chapters or a few verses earlier, verse 7, he says, a genuineness of your faith being more precious than gold that perishes. And so he goes on and talks about fire, purifying gold and silver. And then water, of course, is what purifies, baptism purifies us. And so I think, you know, we struggled with this chapter a little bit, obviously, what is the import. But I think that there's probably quite a bit of evidence that this is certainly used by New Testament writers. As brutal as it was still authorized by God. And it's a type of the total victory that the gospel gives. If you are in Christ, there is nothing that can take you out, that can condemn you. If you remain in Christ and you are obedient, then it is total victory. You will not fail. You will not be won, lost. And I think that imagery is found in the book of Revelation. And as you pointed out rightly a few minutes ago, how wonderful that, you know, when I was younger, I used to think foolishly, if I had lived under the Old Testament, that would have been great to be a warrior. But how foolish that is, because it is a terrible, horrible thing. War, as we know, is awful. And God has given us peace in Christ. Christ came to redeem us from this awful Mosaic covenant.
Very good. Very good. I borrow some of that for the conclusion. Who else? All right, then. Question 5 will be for, let's see, Malin. This one will be for you. How was the plunder divided?
It was divided into 2 parts, those who took part in the war, the soldiers, and then also those who were in the congregation. And we can see that also, you know, of the half that came from the soldiers, one of every 500 person or cattle were to be handed over to Eleazar, the priest, as a heave offering to the Lord. And then of the half that was for the children of Israel, the congregation, one of every 50, so 2%, was to be given to the Levites. And then in verse 42, it talks about the numbers, you know, the half that was given to the congregation. And you have 337,500 sheep, 36,000 cattle, 16,000 people. And we see that there's a lot of spoils here.
The soldiers got a disproportionate amount, as they should have, because, yeah, 12,000 soldiers versus the entirety of Israel. Certainly they would have gotten more, but they earned. They're keeping, as you mentioned, they would have paid less as well in a tithe, essentially. The idea of the heave offering in verse 29, there's a little bit of speculation as to whether that's actually referring to an offering or something more in keeping with a tithe. Let's see. Yeah, so some commentators may take the position that this was something that was just set aside, that the heave, word heave there, could have been used as something given as a tithe. And that seems to be, from the context, what is being alluded to. But ultimately, we don't know. It seems like this was a gift for the Levites. One other thing, this specific arrangement, it's interesting, as you mentioned, Malin, there's a very specific way given here to divide the spoil, to tithe or offer out of it. That seems to only be found here, at least the numbers as it's given, the idea of the 500th and 50th given. But the idea of those at home receiving a share of the spoils does seem to continue throughout Israel's history, Joshua 22:8, among other places. So there was a balance, but this seems to be a special case for whatever reason. And no foregoing rules were given regarding, for instance, how to tie it out of the booty, at least from here. Question number 6, then, the last one. Let's see. Landon, you want it? Cool. What amazing information is revealed by the officers and captains to Moses? How did those men react to this incredible news?
Well, as you said earlier, the amazing news is no one died in battle. 12,000 went out and 12,000 came back. And as for the second part, these men, they made an offering to the Lord as an atonement. Each man was to give ornaments of gold that they found, armlets, bracelets, and other jewelry as the offering.
Yeah, very good. It's kind of difficult to imagine, I think. I mean, we know that God was with his people. God was with these soldiers. And so if they had faith, as is keeping with David and his other mighty men of Israel's history, then they would be safe through battle. But it's an amazing testament to these men that 12,000 went in and every single person had enough faith or was deemed worthy enough by God to survive. Certainly that didn't happen for the vast majority. I'm not sure if it happens again in Israel's history, probably. But it's a testament to the men who went out and to Israel at this time, the faith that they had beginning to approach the Canaan land, to enter into Canaan land, the optimism and the faith that they had, that every single person that went out was found worthy to come back in God's sight. It's an amazing testament to them. Lauren?
Not even just the battle, but there's thousands of animals. So this is a huge cattle and animal drive. Yeah. And none of them died from that either.
Yeah. occupational hazard. Yeah, that could have happened. Anyone else? Bart?
Yeah, I just wanted to make that application to the type again. So how does this apply to us as Christians? So these men, they go out and through the miraculous intervention of God, through this vast campaign, it just was a vast campaign, nobody dies, which obviously is a miracle. And they are redeemed. God has redeemed all of these men from war, even though they may not have deserved it. I don't think they necessarily were. They may have been people that had many issues, no doubt they were. But I think that idea applies to us. So why are we motivated to serve God? Why are we motivated to do what it takes to devote ourselves to purity? It's because of the same reason. So this whole world is under the ban, and there are only few that are going to escape. And we, through Christ, have obtained redemption and mercy. And Paul speaks to this in the letter of Romans. It says, "For you," and this is Romans 11:30, "For as you were once disobedient to God, yet have now obtained mercy through their disobedience." And then he goes on, he talks about how the depths and the riches of God's wisdom and knowledge, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out, who is known the mind of the Lord. And then in chapter 12, verse 1, he says, what do you do then? When you realize that for no good of your own, you have been given mercy and redemption. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." These men were motivated by the same rationale, which is we were given mercy by God, and we've all returned it. And we, as well, rather than, you know, reject the Bible and reject God as a wrathful God who does not deserve to be served, we serve him.
Very good. Couple more small things to sort of go off of that. It's easy to go over these numbers and these different units, and it doesn't really mean necessarily a whole lot to us. And I tried, I don't know if I'm accurate at all, but I tried to do some conversions, and it seems like this is in the range of $6 to $8.5 million worth, at least at current prices, of gold that is given to the service to the temple or tabernacle at this time, the priesthood. And so it's interesting, as Bart spoke to, the depth of gratitude. This wasn't a hollow gratitude. This is something that these men had become very wealthy on this conquest. And the idea of them giving it all back, it speaks to the faith and how moved they were by God's protection through this. And again, as Bart tried to apply it to us, I mean, we don't necessarily have a lot of money to give back, but in the New Covenant, we are able to give something much deeper. Now we're able to give ourselves, our time, our talents, everything that we have to God's kingdom. And that's not something that is a gift that we're necessarily... It's not something that we should just give out of spontaneity. It's something that we're commanded to give. Again, it's a different covenant, more is demanded of us, but certainly that was a great sacrifice for those men of Israel. A couple small things as well. Keelan DeLitch estimated, I'm not sure where they get these numbers, but that the tribe struck down numbered about 150,000 people total. I think that's going off the women who survived. And so within that, maybe you had 35, 40,000 fighting men, is the estimates that they give. And so were that the case, and Midian was a nomadic people, it's not completely out of the realm of possibility that a well-trained fighting force like Israel could have, with good coordination and a surprise attack, routed the men of Midian, who weren't a warring people. I should have mentioned this at the outset, but it seems that Midian was not expecting this attack for whatever reason, that this came as a surprise to them. Ultimately, God was in control, and maybe there's a it caused confusion, whatever, but it seems that this caught Midian unaware, and Israel was well prepared to deal with them. Anyone else? I wanted to read as a closing Psalm 44 verses 1 to 3, which touches on these ideas and I think sums up the emotions that these men felt and that their ancestors later on would feel. Psalm 44, "For we have heard with our ears, O God, our fathers have told us the deeds you did in their days, in days of old. You drove out the nations with your hand, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples and cast them out, for they did not gain possession of the land by their own sword, nor did their own arm save them. But it was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your countenance, because you favored them. If God be for us, who can be against us?